name is Jason Miles. And I am your host for another episode, for another wild ride of This Is Revolution Podcast. So happy Monday. I told you I'd be back Monday. So this is a show we did Thursday night about birth control and abortion in modern China. And also we got into the history, if you will, of the one-child policy in China. Why it was instituted, and in some cases, some of the benefits, as our guest co-host, Summer Tan, who is from China. She was a reporter in China. And our guest, Sarah Mellers Rodriguez, who's an assistant professor at Missouri State University. And I believe she just finished up a book about abortion and birth control in China. It was an interesting book because I did not know, first of all, that people washed out condoms back in the day. You know, there was some background reading that Pascal, Summer, and I had to do, of course, before the show. And you'll hear me talk about some of this in the first hour, and I lead into it for the second hour that is patron only. So if you want to hear our deep dive discussion on the most interesting birth control method that I've ever heard of, there's one way to do it. Patreon.com/Bitter Lake Presents. If you would like to be a part of these conversations, the best way to do it is probably YouTube. That's where all the cool kids are, in the chat. YouTube.com/This Is Revolution Podcast. Of course, we're on Twitch, twitch.tv/This Is Revolution Podcast Oakland. Wherever you're listening to the show, there are links in the description to where you can catch it live. But another thing I had wanted to get into with this show is there was a lot of abortion banning that we talked about. And I was thinking about it in context as I'm reading. Two things came to mind. And one is, currently right now in the United States, we are dealing with a hardcore evangelical right wing. And in some cases, and I don't think that's the Republican Party as a whole. I definitely think it's a faction of it. But the more evangelical side is kind of running the show in places like Texas, for example. Between the state legislature and, you know, all the way up to the governor's office, you have a very hardcore right-wing reactionary side that ideologically wants to ban abortion. And it's no longer kind of a rhetorical talking point to get a base out to vote. And the Texas abortion ban is not the first of its kind. A few years back, was this 2021? So like 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, 2 years ago, Alabama passed an extremely similar law. And I believe it was in Alabama where a pregnant woman got into a fight with another woman. That woman shot the pregnant woman in the stomach, and the pregnant woman got arrested for attempted murder. And that was the loudest case, or maybe kind of the craziest sounding case. But there's been several cases over the last few years, maybe 5 years or so, countless examples of like falling downstairs, getting hit with these charges, car accidents, women getting hit with these charges. So as we talk about black people back to fighting for rights that we won 50 plus years ago, the same can be said for women's reproductive rights. These were rights that were won 40 plus years ago with Roe v. Wade. Trump landed a very powerful blow when he gave businesses the ability to like opt out on birth control for healthcare. Like, we're going to fund birth control for healthcare. So, looking at these cases of countries like Romania is another good example. You know, the Soviet Union, Romania is probably the most modern example of we're going to outlaw abortion, we're going to outlaw contraception to, you know, ramp up this workforce. By the fall of the Soviet Union, you have these orphanages flooded with children. Thousands of women have been killed basically by trying to get these back alley abortions. It was a nightmare. So this examination of the patriarchal nature of the way we look at women's reproductive rights. So that music is it's time for me to shut up now. So please enjoy this conversation. Hopefully you take something from it. Leave me a comment. Leave the show a comment. I am out. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. And I just wanted to show you guys one more time, probably one of the funniest pictures I found in doing research for this show, which was Jackie Chan and a karate condom. I literally Googled Jackie Chan karate condom, and that's what came up. And when we play the intro video for the show, you'll understand why I did look up Jackie Chan karate condom. Before I bring in my co-host, we have a special guest co-host today, but before I bring in my homie, my dog, I want to say happy birthday to my two older sons that you guys never get to see. They are 18 and 15 respectively today. So happy birthday
Jason Dillon and Julian Riley. I love you guys a lot, and I hope to see you soon. Also, want to send a fat ass shout out to a friend of show, Dr. Eric Osgood. He was the guest a few weeks back on our episode about how we get to Medicare for All. His significant other led a charge to raise the wages and get hazard pay for the kitchen staff at their very large corporate-run hospital. So that is a victory for the working class. Shout out to motherfucking the Osgood clan. That being said, I have to introduce my homie, my dog, who now isn't the man that's known for the Mau Mau. He is a self-proclaimed chronic giggler. Pascal Robert, put your hands up.
Peace and greetings to the chat. Peace and greetings to the audience. Peace and greetings, Jason Mile.
That's pretty dope. Remember Eric Osgood? Oh, you weren't on that episode.
I missed that episode for some reason, but I did watch it.
You were gallivanting all over the internet with Mark Lamont Hill and some other fucking black academics.
Whatever, man. Whatever.
I'm such a scorned housewife in this show.
Pause.
And we have a special guest. You may know her as, what would they know her as? She's also gallivanting all over the internet. She was on Movie Night Extravaganza. What other shows has she been on? She's actually a journalist by trade. You may always see her with her significant other, Kuba Rizneski. She is the Summer Tan.
Summer Tan. It's actually my first time going solo without Kuba, but I'm feeling great. Kuba is
listen.
We don't need him. We don't need him.
And it's me.
It's all about Summer Tan empowerment.
That's what I'm talking about. You know what? Shots fired. Take that, Kuba. Take that, Kuba. Now, before we bring in our guest, and we have a very long discussion about condom washing in Mao's China, I learned more about washing condoms in 58 pages of reading than I ever thought I was going to know about condom washing. Pascal, the chronic giggler, have you ever washed a condom?
I'd rather not disclose that information at this particular. No, I've never washed.
You don't want to tell everybody that you wash condoms?
No, I've never washed a condom.
I've never even heard of washing a condom. I mean, this was
how about awesome. Washing them and saving them for reuse?
Saving them for later. Imagine going into a gentleman's house and he's just got his old condoms lying around. And he has.
You don't know how uncomfortable I feel having this conversation with Summer. You just don't know how.
Hey, Summer, you've washed a condom or two.
Listen, man.
No, too rich for that.
The more you know. So before we bring in our esteemed guest, let's play the.
Going to discuss quite frankly the things that are normal and to be expected in the development of children in relation to sex.
Every so often I get a strong sex urge, and the only way I can take care of it is to masturbate. And when I do, I feel awful. It's just like I've committed a crime or something. And it worries me, and I say, well, I won't do it anymore. And when I do, it goes away for a while, and I come back and do it again. And when I do control myself for a while, I end up with a wet dream.
George, I'm really pleased that you can tell me about this. Perhaps it...
In 1982, China's population crossed the 1 billion mark, only 3 years after the promulgation of its famous, or in some quarters, infamous, one-child policy, a policy that was abolished in 2015. That China's ruling Communist Party might be concerned with questions of overpopulation in the world's most populous country seems to make intuitive sense. However, such a perspective is perhaps oversimplistic as it obscures the complex history of birth control in modern China. For instance, upon assuming control of China in 1949, the initial stance of the Communist Party was one that favored high fertility rates. What factors have shaped both the attitudes of the Chinese state and Chinese society towards the issue of birth control? How have policies and attitudes changed regarding this issue since the Communist Party assumed power? And what have been the implications for gender relations in the world's most populous nation? We ask these questions and more. This is Revolution.
Unless you're an extremely unusual audience, you will welcome some of this help, because most people, parents or young people who are concerned about their own attitudes, have not in their own lives had the opportunity to gain this kind of insight.
Please don't forget to hit like and subscribe on your way out. You can catch... So you guys know to hit like and subscribe, I hope. Before we bring our guest in, I just want her to know that I do read everything that Jean gives us for, like, you know, be prepared for the show, because I didn't know what to do for a video. He goes, we're going to talk about birth control in modern China. Or he asks first. He doesn't just say, this is what we're going to do. He asks first. And I was like, sure, that sounds like a great topic. He goes, Summer Tan, come on. She knows all about this stuff. So Gene said, you know all about condom washing. So don't shoot the messenger. And after reading it, I was like, oh, dude, I got to look up some stuff. And that was the first, I'm sure there were condom ads before that, but that was the first condom ad I could find. And it was like a really big deal that there was a push for, condom ads. I guess there was a bad AIDS outbreak in the early 90s in China. And I watched that actual commercial, because if I were to play the audio, you guys would still be laughing. I've probably watched it 47 times in a row. Easy 47 times in a row. I couldn't stop laughing. So speaking of chronic giggling, I can see our guest in the virtual green room. Sarah Mellers Rodriguez is an assistant professor of East Asian history at Missouri State University. Her forthcoming book examines birth control and abortion in China from the earliest 20th century to present. And I think it's very relevant to where we are now in the United States, as we're seeing a lot of laws that are banning abortion in, you know, 6 weeks. So we're going to get into that in this discussion. We're also going to talk about the one-child policy in China. So please welcome Dr. Sarah Mellers Rodriguez. Can you hear us?
Yep.
Excellent.
Welcome. So a lot of your writing, it was interesting to me, because I never think about the patriarchal nature of the way we look at contraception. Can you tell us a little bit about how just that structure, can you word it better for me, Pascal? Cause you're a smart guy.
I think the best question, the way to frame it, is that how the world, the view of contraception was shaped by the social position of men, or the view of males and masculinity in China, both pre-communist period and continuing.
So, I mean,
Gender relations as they relate to contraception, of course, are specific to like different cultural groups and different time periods and stuff. In modern China, or in 20th century China anyway, from my experience researching for my book, I found that, and granted, it's an awkward question to go around to people asking them, so when you have sex, who uses, or who whips out the birth control? Whose job is it? But I found by and large, it was almost exclusively women who were kind of policing the bounds of not having babies because, well, for obvious reasons, it's going to impact them more than it's going to impact a man. But that's not, it changes across time. There's also, if we look at like sex and birth control in modern Europe, actually up until recently in some places it was normal for men to provide condoms because it was thought of as manly, like, hey baby, I've got a condom, and the woman's like, ooh, he's a real man. But there's a real power differential because only one person's going to get stuck being pregnant in the pre-STD STI kind of conversation, only one person's going to be pregnant, and of course it's going to be the one who is the woman, or the one who's able to get pregnant.
You know, one of the things that I found very fascinating about your work is that how you illustrate issues of contraception, birth control, and reproduction were very much a conscious part of state planning in China, that it was a very much part of the vision of the nation state. Can you talk about the origins of that particular impetus in the development of China? And does it come about as a result of the revolution that leads to the birth of the Chinese Communist Party? Or is this even something that happens in the period, as you talk about the period from the period of the Republic to the Chinese Communist Party, to modern China as well? Because it does seem that there was even a pre-communist concern about contraception as well, that kind of takes metastasizes, if you will, grows in the Chinese Communist Party period. Can you talk about the different ways in which it becomes a state project in those different periods?
Yeah. So sometimes I feel like because my work is on birth control and abortion, I'm overly super narrowly focused. Like, is this actually important, or is this just me? But I'm confident at this point that there birth control and fertility have always played a really important part in nation building, and not just in China, but all over the world. So how is a modern family conceptualized? What does that family look like? Who are the children's loyalties to? Is it to their parents, or is it to the nation state? As in the comments we're seeing, taking care of the elderly, it's part of kind of a structure of society. So children need to be taking care of their parents in old age, and the parents are kind of representing the state. All this is to say that birth control in its various forms has, and childbearing has always played a really important role in state building. And particularly in coming into the 20th century around the world, scholars and just random eugenicists, racists, people with no qualifications whatsoever, ever other than being rich or powerful, we're having these very loud global conversations about what it means to be a modern person. And they repeatedly kept coming back to the idea that we need to control the way people reproduce. And Chinese elites got wind of that as the final Chinese imperial dynasty, the Qing dynasty, was falling, and they said this could be our way kind of to recover our nation's status. They had, for a little like bit of background information, in the 19th century, European and American powers had forced their way into China, basically expediting a process of decline that was already going. But anyway, so sorry, I keep seeing the comments. I'm like, oh, comment. So there was this process of decline already happening. Now all of these foreign powers start barging their way in, and Chinese elites are looking around for a way to like make sense of this. How can we recover Chinese values, Confucian values? How can we save our nation? And one of the things they turned to was thinking about social engineering. How can we modify the population to make it stronger? How can we modify the household unit, the family unit, gender relations, things like that? So heading into the 20th century, those conversations were already going on. And as the Qing Dynasty fell, it became more and more urgent. Like, we need to fix this now. China's way of life is basically collapsing. And there's these foreigners basically just taking over our country. We literally, if we don't come up with a solution, we're never going to be respected, and our values will disappear. And so all of that kind of sentiment and baggage gets packaged in with fertility. So it becomes a lot, it's not never just about fertility, it's about politics, it's about nation building, it's about normative gender roles in the eyes of the state and things like that. And so when the Communist Party comes to power in 1949, it inherits all of that baggage and continues to build on what had already been going on. But none of the previous things have been forgotten. That makes sense.
I'd like to hear, Summer, do you have some input you'd like to contribute?
Yeah, first of all, I really, really enjoyed the readings, and it kind of brings me back to the my graduate school, where like before a discussion, I need to do these readings. But I really like them. As a Chinese national, I couldn't help but feel a little bit, I wouldn't say proud, but more understanding of what the government is doing, like how many times they went back and forth to get something right, because there's literally no precedent in front of them to follow. Like they cannot learn from the Qing Dynasty, the Kuomintang, or Soviet, let alone Westerners. They literally have to figure a lot of things out by themselves, and they made mistakes. But then like it would be a very, very different China without those efforts. A lot of things they didn't get it right, but I also certainly to be able to understand that, I think it's a gift. And also I really appreciate how objective you are examining these issues, not only just to say that this is the gender roles are primarily like male, and like Chinese females didn't bear in anything. No, there were discussions mentioned about those like female literatures in this conversation.
I'm sorry, Summer, I thought you were done. Please finish. I'm sorry.
No worry. I just, the train of thought is just gone. But anyways, I really appreciate that. Yeah, and there's so many factors at play, like the male's perspective, those kind of association with sex workers, like state policies. There's a lot of issues, and I really typically, apart from the washout condom stuff, I typically enjoy the part about yin and yang discussion, like that notion, like ejaculating would give away positive energy. So a condom is a very bad thing, because then you lose all those energy without having things taking back. I'm like, I've never thought about that, but that's so true.
That's my line. That's why I got all these kids. You're throwing off the jing and the jang. I can't give you enough jang if you don't let me have this jing.
I knew we were going to go into that. I had a feeling we were going to go there.
But she wrote it.
I remember.
She wrote it. I didn't write it. She wrote it. Melis Rodriguez wrote it.
This is my jam.
But speaking of jing and jang, and janging all over the place, but the feminist contingent in the Chinese Communist Party had a lot to say about contraception. But one thing you write about is
all the talk about contraception, vasectomies were never part of the discourse. And tying those bad boys up works just as well, last I checked. Did you want to, can you elaborate on the conversations that were had between in the Chinese Communist Party about contraception, especially from a feminist perspective?
So it's interesting. So the conversation, oddly enough, hasn't really changed. In the 1950s, some women were saying, hey, we want access to birth control. On the one hand, they wanted it to be kind of female-centered so that they don't have to rely on the man to be like, I promise I'm going to use the condom, and then he doesn't use it. On the other hand, though, if you have a population where like 40% of women who are able to reproduce have IUDs or have sterilizations, that's a lot. So the conversation starts out as we need to have sterilization be an option. Please, please, please give it to us as a choice. The Communist Party said, okay, but only in really, really special circumstances. And then we see this really quick turnaround within, 15 or 20 years, where it goes from being something that people really want but can't have to something that they have to have and don't want necessarily. And from the male perspective, women kept saying, hey, their stuff is half the problem. They're half the reason there are so many children. And men had all of these different reasons why it couldn't be them. Oh, I have to go to work. Oh, it could harm me for life. I had an interview once that will stay with me for a long time because it made me laugh so hard. I was interviewing this gentleman. This is actually a good story. Do we have time for a story?
Go for it.
So this gentleman, I interviewed him when he was 81, and I interviewed him when he was 84. When he was 84, he said, hey, young lady, you look familiar. I don't know why everyone's interested in this topic of the one-child policy all of a sudden. A young lady who looked just like you, but cuter and thinner, interviewed me about this topic like 2 months ago. And I said, oh, that was me, but that was 3 years ago. and he's like, oh, I guess it's possible. Anyway, so I interviewed him and I asked him about his thoughts about sterilization. He said, oh, you'll be really, I heard that if you get a sterilization, you become like a eunuch or like the Pillsbury Doughboy. You swell up really big and you get really kind of gelatinous and you lose your figure. And so I refuse to be sterilized for that reason because I don't want to lose my figure. And I don't, that's obviously not a standard response, but I found it to be really clever, especially the guy's like a great grandfather and he's trying to work on his figure.
Somebody, you want to jump in?
He probably isn't even joking or isn't even like lying, because like sex education is really terrible. My parents, if they know I'm here talking about condom, they could probably kill me. But so they actually literally don't know the pros and cons of vasectomy. So like, I wouldn't be surprised if he's actually very genuine saying that I believe that it's definitely bad. It's blocking my chi and such.
I mean, he said he knew somebody who got a vasectomy and that guy got fat afterwards. So, I mean, he has evidence. It's not necessarily like cause and effect, but there's definitely correlation in his mind.
That's my new excuse. Why don't you just get a vasectomy? You know, the weight gain. And I got to go to work. So that between going to work, weight gain, I no vasectomy for me. What? Go ahead, Pascal.
Can you actually talk about how the issue of sterilization, procreation, and productivity become a major kind of focus of the Chinese nation state, and in which period the outlook of reproduction and procreation changes and shifts from, you know, have as many kids as possible, the state needs, you know, more babies, more work, to the one child policy? Can you kind of talk about that evolution and what causes that?
Yeah. So in the Republican period, so in the period between the fall of the Qing Dynasty and the beginning of communist Maoist China, the state is ostensibly natalist, so it is encouraging people to have as many kids as possible. There are like constraints on who can have abortions, and you could be punished for using birth control, but the real emphasis on productivity, like work productivity being tied to reproductive productivity, definitely comes from the Soviet influence. It's in those first few years when the Communist Party is in power and is really trying its very best to copy basically what's the failed model of the Soviet Union, in which women are supposed to be having as many children as possible. Why? Because the more babies you have, the more workers you have. The Communist Party comes to power officially in 1949. Already by 1953, the problem is becoming apparent. So very quickly, the Communist Party has barely been in power very long when the first census is taken, and it becomes clear that in just a little over 3 years, the population has increased by 60 million people in a really short window of time. At times the population growth rate is like between 25 and I want to say almost 40%. It's really high. And so suddenly people start thinking, well, maybe we've taken this too far. We do want to have a large population, but maybe this isn't the best way to do it. And these feminist leaders are saying, if you want us to be both productive and reproductive, there's a limit to the amount of time we have. If I have 9 kids, I'm not going to be able to work full time in the factory. And of course, then there's, other responsibilities. And so through this ongoing conversation, finally, they decide that if a woman is very sick and has had a certain number of children, she'll be allowed to be sterilized or to undergo abortion. But the idea isn't really that to make her life better so much as to make her more like a better worker.
You had a really interesting cartoon that you put in one of your pieces where there's a man that doesn't want to have a kid, and he gives his wife like these pills from an apothecary or like something like that. And he's like, look, I gave her the goddamn pills, the no kid pills, and she's still shitting out these kids. And the ad was supposed to show kind of the backwards nature of the people in the countryside, because one thing that you do actually point out, and I would really love Summer to get into this as well, is the fact that there are divisions when it comes to education. And the further out you go into the countryside, and I think people need to remember, when we think about China, we think about modern China as this industrial nation. It was an agrarian economy. It was a third world country, what we refer to as third world country at the time. And you're trying to turn this this nation into an industrial nation. So, of course, like Pascal mentioned before, have more babies. And China is not the only country that was doing this around the same time, probably a little bit afterwards. It was Romania. The president of Romania had outlawed contraception and abortions. And of course, they had a horrible problem with just kind of feral children, if you will. So I do want to ask you about education and the lack of education, because you also talk about that in your research. You didn't just interview the educated masses in the major metropolitan areas. You also talked to people that didn't have the ability to read. And one thing they referenced in your study was, well, a lot of the population here is illiterate, so they wouldn't be able to even have access to these books. I think that there's a book about sexual education that husbands would give to their wife on wedding night if you had means, which I also thought was interesting. Like, hey, honey, this is about to happen, so read up on it. It's like, wow. So if Summer, you want to go first, or Sarah, and elaborate on the fact that there's a lack of education that's also leading to a lot of misinformation coming out.
Yeah, I can start with like real life experiences I know, and maybe Sarah could summarize them in a very nice way. Like, there's definitely a big rural urban division, and my family, they're from like small towns / rural areas, so none of these knowledge were ever accessible to them, and they and it's very interesting because my grandparents' generation, they have a lot of kids. Like, both of my grandparents have like 5-6 kids, and they all ended with a son, because of course you need, if you like, son is a real thing, like daughters is just meh, it's just a side product. And I know for sure, like, at least one of my grandparents were illiterate. They have no idea what contraception, or they don't have much knowledge. They can probably count, they can definitely count, like, very but they just, those knowledge are too new and too remote to them. And my parents' generation, they, most of them have one child care. That's why I have a lot of cousins. I don't have a sibling, so I treat cousins as siblings. I never had the courage to ask them about what sex education they received, but like, they had me relatively late in their life, like 27, compared to other like the other men and women in their generations, because they go to college, they have work and etc. But I don't know, I never asked, but my generation, terrible sex education. Like, I don't even remember if there's any textbook handed out about sex education. But if there were any, they're going to be so ridiculed by my classmates. No one take them seriously. Most of the knowledge they have is from pornography that's pirated from Japan. So, like, we don't know a lot of stuff. And if you're really curious, and if you're devoted to have a good sex life, you'll probably go search out yourself. But a lot of that is banned because sex related, it's censored. So like, the venue where you would get those knowledge is real limited, and you really have to dig them out. And as you mentioned in the paper, the ads for abortion, it's just so widespread. So like, it's like such a like painless thing. Like, how can it ever be painless? But nevertheless, you'll see them in buses. But then condom ads are banned on buses. So it's very ironic to me. So in general, I think sex education is near vacant in our most of Chinese lives, and even though some of them appear, it would be banned because some parents got paranoid. So I would say that lack of sex education is a huge factor, and but I don't ever see like a new initiative introducing good educations. So I don't know. So, but that's my experience and people around me.
That's Professor, super interesting.
Professor Rodriguez, do you want to add in, chime in as well?
If you don't mind. That was really interesting. I love hearing about people's experiences growing up and sort of where we all fit into the bigger human story. But it's definitely not just a Chinese thing, and that's something I try to emphasize in school. Like, it's not, for me anyway, yeah, this is a problem in China, but it's a problem in a lot of other places, and we would be remiss to kind of China blame or blame regular people when, I mean, I live in Missouri, and I make a point, even though it's probably highly inappropriate, in my intro to world history class, we usually do at least one lesson about the history of education, LGBTQ education. I always ask students, what do you know? When did you learn about sex ed? Do you know about like queer sex? Do you know about straight sex? And invariably it comes back to, I watched a lot of porn and now I know. And I'm like, okay.
That's pretty scary.
I'd like to add that I did not grow up in the internet age. I'm 44, so I grew up with cable. And everything I know, I know from Cinemax.
That's even more scary.
Yes, that means I have very, very dull sex, but it does have a soundtrack.
That's I can relate. Well, I can relate to that because my college.
I can relate to that. He's boring.
Especially for girls, like if you are a boy, like you will get pornography from elsewhere. But if you're a girl, how are you gonna get that? Like you're a good girl and educated. So some of my classmates in college, they had shocking little knowledge about their own bodies. And there were times when we're like at night, we were like a few more educated girls would explain them to them. They were all shocked. Like, and maybe a few years ago, there was a couple that couldn't get a kid for a few years and then went to hospital. And turns out they never know how really how to make sex. They really thought
he was going in the wrong hole the whole time.
Yeah, you see,
that's really funny, actually. Like, it's okay to laugh at that.
They sleep together, and why didn't
I don't baby know why she's not pregnant. I'm hitting that navel like it says do.
Pretty much like that.
In some of Sarah's writing, I don't know if you missed this, Pascal. I read this shit twice, and I'm really mad. I took notes, and that's why I'm so off on my questions. I'm so sorry. My iPad died, and I had saved all the notes I was going to take and passages I was going to read. But there was one passage you wrote about modern day China and young men not knowing how to put on condoms. And if I'm a young lady or man that's about to have intercourse with someone and they're looking at a condom and their dick like it's a goddamn Rubik's cube, I think I might have to pass on that. Like, nothing good is going to happen here if you're struggling with this shit. And if you watch the Jackie Chan and the Karate Condom, the Karate Condom actually explains how to put one on, because as you, again, you write about, this is still a relatively, I don't want to say new thing, but it's still not really talked about that much, condoms and sex education.
Yeah.
Why do you look so uncomfortable? Stop it. I'm going to keep making dick jokes all night. You could have said no. You saw when Jean booked her.
I'm actually interested in kind of moving to this subject that Jason is bringing on about, because I read both your pieces in particular. I was fascinated with the one about the aversion to condom use in China, particularly compared to the other Asian countries. And I was wondering, you know, what exactly is the overall perception of sexuality in China as a what are the driving forces? Is it culture? Is it the Taoism? Is it the Communist Party? What are the normative institutions in Chinese society that shape the sexual attitudes that particularly young people have? And are they in flux because of the rising industrial power of China as a nation?
Absolutely. That's a fantastic question. And I'm actually finishing up something I'm writing about the like origins of Communist Party sex education. And it's it's great fun to read the texts that were being promoted. I'm bringing this up because it brings to light kind of the ideas the state has for people about sex and the ideas that regular people have for sex and about sex. And over the course of like 70 years, they've slowly converged. But initially the state would say, you know, masturbation is bad. Sexual desire is bad. You should think of people of the opposite sex that you are attracted to as friends. You should try to keep your hymen intact before marriage because, you know, chastity is important. Men should not think about sex or read anything that could lead them to think about sex, which at a certain age, I'm pretty sure everything leads them to think about sex. But the state is giving these kind of top-down normative guidelines, not even the state, they're sort of representatives, unofficial representatives of the state. But it's very obvious that this is in conversation with what I would call like normal people's attitudes, because there wouldn't, the state wouldn't feel the need to say stop masturbating so much if there wasn't an issue with people masturbating because they're human and normal. But I, in my experience, I think kind of normative attitudes have shifted in the direction of what the state wants, because the state is so powerful. It can't control everything. And often the state's messages are changing and are conflicting, and that leaves room for people to get their own ideas. But I think the state really wants to have a monopoly on how people approach sex, in a kind of almost creepy way. bringing that into like the state power into the bedroom. And all states do that to an extent, but in China, in some ways, it's more obvious.
Well, I mean, the thing is, as ironic is that we're talking about bringing state power into the bedroom, and we're in a state in the United States right now where, you know, female reproduction and the ability of women to control it is literally up for grabs, particularly in the state of Texas and other places. So at the same time, let's talk about how that translates into the one child policy in China, particularly, you know, so when we're talking about how the state's vision for reproduction and planning and development is really the exegesis that really drive sexual behavior and reproduction. How does the one child policy come about, and how is it governed, and how is that actually effectuated by the state in China?
So the one-child policy, I think it off for various reasons, it gets a lot of backlash, and I'm not here to support it in any way, but it does come out of a particular historical moment when people everywhere around the world, at least people who had power, intellectual elites, politicians, et cetera, were all advocating for limiting population growth. So those ideas, they kind of emerged in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And in the post-war period, post-World War II, people were genuinely worried that the world's running out of resources. We need to limit, in the eyes of sort of like white Western upper middle class leaders, we need to make sure that the people, darker people of the world, don't have more children. And I think Chinese scientists and elites took that very much to heart, and they also saw this as a way to kind of recover China's lost reputation that had been lost in the 19th century. So they thought, we sort of buy into this social scientific model that we need to curb population growth to get wealthy, that's a way to kind of make the nation great again. But it's definitely, it is extreme in the Chinese context, but it's in, like, there's this book, Unnatural Selection, that talks about, Fatal Misconception, that talks about like the world's population industry, as it's called. And there's these people all over the world who are advocating for basically taking reproductive rights away from minorities, from poor people, from religious minorities, racial and ethnic minorities. And the United States is actually at the forefront of that movement.
Doesn't surprise me. There's always been a Malthusian kind of eugenics related tinge to global population planning that goes back, you know, even to, you know, Thomas Malthus himself. I mean, this is not unconnected at all to the spread of imperialism on Western development whatsoever. But Summer, did you want to jump in?
You explain before you answer, Summer, what Malthusianism is? Don't be one of those guys. You have to explain what that shit is.
Thomas Malthus was a British philosopher that basically talked about the fear and the problem with population growth and its development in terms of how would it affect societies economically. And he's believed to be the father of the notion that, you know, we should try to cull the population and cut it down to maintain the effectiveness of managing economies and societies as well. And that type of actual worldview has been a dominant part of Anglo-American global planning for quite a long period of time.
I was going to add that exactly what the Rob what Pascal said. Sorry. Because his name is also like Thomas Robert Malthus, so he had a huge influence on, I guess, state planning in China, because he was brought up a lot of times since I grew up. And it's interesting. I don't know if Karl Marx ever wrote anything about gender and sex. It's probably better. China is probably better off if he wrote anything, because there's really no model for China to follow. And the orthodox Marxist thoughts never really had anything good about state planning. And so these guys really had to figure out on their own. But on the other hand, like, I think China is sometimes a little bit too effective, like for one child policy. If the government is not that good at enforcing it, then it probably would fall apart, but it didn't. Like, it stick around and it was really effective. China, now India is going to surpass China right now. And one thing I noticed about China's governance is that the local, like sometimes central government would just publish a guideline, but then like due to like incentives for promotion, the local government will really take effort to enforce them, and sometimes making it more stricter and stricter and stricter. I had an aunt, she just really wants a son. She already had three girls, and so she is determined, and she eventually had a son. That's my cousin right now. He's successful. That song costed her whole house. I think they tore her house down because she just disobeyed the rule. And they're really poor. There's nothing else to. And also that was her fourth kid. So that means she went 3-4 times against the rule. So that's why. It was really terrible for the family. But
there's a lot of myths about the one child policy and how strict the punishments were. So I actually do want to hear what you guys have to say about people that are definitely against the one child policy. Well, it's different now. It was killed in 2015, but. What would you say to people that were arguing that this is, you know, authoritarian dictatorship here because you have a one-child policy? And, you know, some of the myths I heard, which were very, very crazy back in the day, were like they were going to kill parents if you have too many kids. And it seems like it was more of an issue of fines. Now, if you are a more well-to-do family, were you better off than the families in the countryside when it came to the one child policy, if you wanted to have more children? Because obviously people did have more children.
I like in my experience with the China one child policy, it's more hearsay, but it's my relative. So I think it's mostly true. For one, it is like for rural area, it's not really one child policy. If you have one girl, you can have another kid. That's the rule. So in those places, it's very common they have two kids. And it also, it kind of varies based on different culture locally, because people in like southern China, like Guangdong and Fujian, they really, 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 really want a son. So it's like even in 2000s, where like they just have kids, whatever they, and they are good at making money, I guess. So they just pay fine. As long as you pay fine, they more or less leave you alone, at least in the 21st century. But the exception is that if you have government related jobs, like if you are a civil servant or if you are hired by like state owned institutions like schools, hospitals, you will lose your job because you are supposed to be good, be a model of the society by having government-related jobs. So like my parents, they could not have another kid for that reason. They could have paid a fine, or but then losing jobs, especially those iron balls, that's a huge thing. And the last point is corruption, of course, because if you have money, you don't need to have pay fine, because the fine is sometimes huge. But if you bribe the right person, you could probably get away with it. So there's a lot of legal room. It's not just like I guess there were in like maybe 70s, 80s, they were very, very strictly enforced, also based on where you are. But there's a lot of ways to get around that. And like in general, people still have ways to get around it. Like even if you don't want to pay fine, you could just have the kid unregistered and wait until the situation gets better, and then you register the kid again. So there's a lot of room around that.
That's a beautiful description. Thank you so much. It's really spot on, in my opinion.
Thank you.
Can you explain and also, how does state planning lead to the famine? State planning of planning families kind of lead to the overconsumption that leads to this massive famine.
Oh, you mean the Great Leap Forward, a Great Leap Famine in the 1950s? Mm-hmm. There's not really, I don't know if it's a great correlation between the Great Leap Famine and people were having a lot of babies, but the famine itself was a product of collectivizing everything at a point when China really wasn't ready to be collectivized, and then mixed with a bunch of other things like corruption and people being so busy doing things like smelting iron in their backyards that they didn't have time to be working in the fields. I think the bigger impact of this great famine is it made it obvious that the Communist Party's big promise that everyone's going to have, you know, have as many kids as you want, because this is the communist dream. We're going to have like free food and free jobs for everyone, and everyone's going to get housing and everyone's going to get childcare, that it became very obvious that they couldn't really deliver.
Yeah. When I was young, I asked my grandpa, like, I heard Cultural Revolution was terrible. Was it really terrible? And he said, no, not as much as Bravely Forward. And in China, I think we associate with more with, well, at least in the education I received, whether or not that's true, it's beyond my knowledge, is that the famine was created by, well, was right after some natural disasters. So it was kind of dissociated with the Great Leap Forward campaign with the disasters. But also I heard like from family story that like people would kill for a job in the like public canteen or public like dining, because then when they give out food, they could sometimes save a little bit for their family. But so that's what happens when you have a collective, community, I guess. But those that weren't so lucky or didn't have the right person at the right job is really, really terrible. I have relatives that are malnourished in their childhood. So they're really like they're shorter, or they never get like they're always thin. It's terrible.
I mean, this definitely was a challenge to try to take a country that was a majority agrarian peasant society and try to industrialize it for purposes of security in such a short period of time is going to cause massive dislocation and problems. But you know the capacity of being able to try to weather that and plan a society is going to be challenging without a doubt. But the question becomes is that in modern China, how has China been able to take the lessons of that particular history and do things like, for example, poverty reduction and industrialization on a larger scale, and still be able to seemingly, at least from the outside, be improving the quality of life for a large percentage of its population while still having weathered that particular period of time. So my question is that has these issues of population and these issues of reproduction, has the Chinese government or the Chinese Communist Party learned a lesson from the past in terms of how they view these things today in terms of its future kind of strategic planning.
I don't like Sarah's face on that.
I have an overly expressive face. I apologize.
No, that's a pretty real face right there.
Did the Chinese Communist Party learn its lesson? I like to think so, but I don't know if you've seen the most recent kind of news about abortion in China. Now they're going to be restricting access to abortion to encourage population growth.
Yeah, it's like they always learn. I feel Chinese, we have such a long history, so we always learn from the past. But there's a question of what lessons you learned. There are some, certainly I think those experiences has taught China that you have to be rich and strong. You have to support your population, and you have to be strong internationally so that like people don't just beat you out of nowhere because you're so weak and you cannot defend yourself. So China has certainly made a promise that it wants to be rich and rich for the citizens, and more or less it delivered its promise. It's extraordinary, but like it takes means to get there, and there are sometimes you don't like life doesn't give you a unicorn. You don't get everything you want in the world, so there's a lot of consequences. But like literally when I was young, I hated going back to the rural area for Chinese New Year, where my dad's parents live, where my like uncle and my grandparents live. I just don't want to go there because the situation is horrible. I live in a small city and we have good, like Soviet sized apartments, but in a rural area, there were literally shitholes. There's no toilet. And then there was one that.
Oh, like, you mean a shithole?
Literally, it's a hole where
you literally.
I literally mean that. It's not like Trump's whole country. Literally, like as a kid, I had problems going there, especially when you're so every family member is playing mahjong. You had to go there yourself in the dark. Sometimes they're detached from the main house, and sometimes they're built inside the pig house, so like the pig is literally watching you. It's horrible. So like
bugs. Oh god, the bugs, and you're like that's a sacred area. Why are there bugs there?
Oh my god, me terrified to crap in rural China.
But like recently, like some of them are like they're all better off. They all have good houses in the area. Like people used to all want to rush into rural areas. Now they all want to rush into urban housing, and now some of them go back to rural because in urban areas you don't get land, but in rural areas you can build something, you can have land, you can trade. But so it's just different. And I'm like, cause I live in the central China, so that's where that's usually like things got. We are 10 years behind, 20 years behind Shanghai probably. But like the fact that they can live a good life, they have hot showers now. Like I have no idea. I have no doubt that those people really, really love government because for good reasons they delivered, right? Like you cannot expect them to sympathize with people they don't know, right? That had bad experiences, because from their own experience, their life changed a million times, right? And for them, like one child policy, it's a small price to pay. But that's probably the mentality for a lot of Chinese. It's a questionable in other ways, but for them, it's very real.
Well, I have the link on the screen to the patron, because we're heading into our Patreon only after our segment, where we're going to take a deeper dive. I wanted to get into it on the first hour, but we didn't get a chance to get there with where we are right now with a lot of the abortion regulation that we're seeing and a rollback of Roe v. Wade from a kind of rogue faction of the Republican Party, which I think is kind of their Achilles heel here in the States, and kind of comparing China's policies I also want to take another look at Romania. I really kind of get mildly annoyed whenever you see some sort of abortion protest and people are always dressed up like a Margaret Atwood novel. That is fiction. There is reality that you can look to in recent years to show you the errors of when you try to ban contraception, the patriarchal nature of banning contraception, and we have to take a very deep dive into my favorite part of Sarah Mellor's writing. Mellor's Rodriguez, sorry. I don't want to disrespect any names in the house. He could be sitting right behind you. Hey, you motherfucker better say Rodriguez. About the one of the greatest forms of contraception that I didn't know existed that includes squeezing a man's nuts till one pops out of the sack. So thank you guys. If you're not a patron, there's the link right there. Do it, because I'm opening up with Sarah Mellor's explanation of one of the craziest forms of contraception. Sception. The taint push ball squeeze. Thank you guys. Have a good night. We'll be right back.